Hi, and welcome back to another one of my 78 RPM podcasts. This time I'm going to start with an artist I happen to have got some records of quite recently. I've had quite a few of his records for some time, of course. His name is Heinrich Schlusnus. He was one of the great, if not the greatest, German baritone. He was born in 1888 and died in 1952, and thus was just about contemporary with Hitler. So one of the things one has to ask oneself is, what was his stance during the Hitler regime? And he's got one of those unfortunate faces that, well, you have the impression that he looks like the archetypal hard-bitten Nazi. He was a little bit more complicated than that, however. For instance, although he attended some of the high Nazis' birthday parties in the 30s, he also put up in his own house a Jewish conductor. So, whatever he was, it certainly wasn't a hard-bitten Nazi. And I suppose you had to survive during those 12 years. He was certainly cleared of any wrongdoing after the war and lived to make his last recordings around 1950. He died at the age of 63, not very long after actually retiring from the stage. His early career was in opera, and he began it around World War I, performing with a prestigious, renowned Berlin State Opera, starting from 1917. And he carried on singing there right to the end of his career, although after he toured Chicago in the 27-28 period, and after the Bayreuth Festival in 33, he tended to turn more and more to doing concerts rather than opera, and he became one of the great leader singers. However, it is his ability to sing Verdi which most interests me. A lot of his recordings, sadly, are in German, as you might expect, because in those days people tended to record in the language of wherever they lived. But he could and did record very well in Italian. And it's one of those arias I'm going to give you now. Since he recorded in the electrical era, we can hear his voice pretty clearly, and it's a wonderful voice that he had. He was also, as I say, a wonderful lieder singer, and didn't sing it in that, that terrible sort of precious way that a lot of modern lieder singers, possibly with not too much voice, deliver those songs. They spend so much time on the words, they forget the music most of the time. He didn't do that. Well, let's go back nevertheless to his Italian language Verdi recordings. Here's one of the best of the lot.
Partigiani di razza dannata, per qual prezzo vendesti il mio bene? Avai nulla per loro conviene, ma mia figlia è impagabil tesor. La rendete, o seppur disarmata, questa man, se vuoi farla cruenta, nulla in terra più l'uomo paventa. Sede via, dipende. Dimmi tu dove l'anima pietà, ridete a me la figlia, tutto il mondo è dal figlia per me. Ridete a me la figlia, tutto il mondo. Pietà, pietà, signori, pietà, signori, pietà.
Heinrich Schlusnus, singing, of course, the great Rigoletto aria, where Rigoletto berates all the courtiers as these corrupt people that they are. Well, as I've often said, it's amazing the number of people from completely diverse sorts of arts who were born around the same time. 2 years before him, there was born in the Ukraine a baby who at that time was called Sonia Kalish, name you will never have heard of, no doubt. After only a couple of years, they left Ukraine, where the family lived, and moved to the USA. Her parents opened a restaurant, and pretty early on she started singing for tips in her mum and dad's restaurant. She was married very briefly at the age of 17, despite the fact she was rather on the tubby side, to put it mildly, to a man called Lewis Tuck, and she liked that surname and decided to change her name despite the fact that the marriage didn't last, to Tucker. And as you probably guessed, she would be known for the rest of her life as Sophie Tucker. When she started performing more professionally, she was persuaded for various reasons to perform in blackface, which was still an accepted thing back then. But she did more than just perform in blackface and be billed as a coon shouter, which she certainly wasn't. She actually espoused the cause of African-American influenced songs, fell in love with them. Indeed, she hired some of the best black singers of the time to give her lessons and got black composers to write songs for her act. She even appeared in the famous Ziegfeld Follies as early as 1909, and the only reason she didn't last there was that she was so successful that the other women in the show refused to have her on the bill with them because it spoiled the audience for them. However, she soon got in with William Morris, the founder of the famous William Morris Agency, which still exists, of course. And he said, look, you don't need your black face, get rid of that. And she then became herself and gradually became more and more famous. And her big, big first hit was as early as 1911, a song which is still known today called Some of These Days. It came out on Edison and then again in 1926. In the early 20s, she hired somebody called Ted Shapiro as her accompanist and musical director. And he worked with her pretty much throughout the rest of her career. And she became as famous as all the great black singers on the vaudeville circuit. And she would, of course, lace her songs with a lot of humour, and she built up the sort of stage personality she would have for the rest of her life, which was a mixture of sentimentality and, as she called herself, the last of the Red Hot Mamas. She still wasn't, nevertheless, averse to taking lessons from people like Mamie Smith and Ethel Waters, who, of course, were the great black stars of the time. One of her biggest hits, again, was My Yiddish Mama, going on the sentimental side, but she came to London in the late 20s and made a recording back here in London, which was a song which was much more in the black vaudeville tradition, and it's called Washing the Blues from My Soul. This is recorded on a broadcast 78 in November 1930. This is Sophie Tucker at probably the height of her powers, and as I like to remember her, because later on she occasionally got to be a little bit of a caricature of herself. This is Sophie Tucker at her best.
Down with useless cares and a voice within says, hurry down through the lowlands, but trudging along with eyes up to heaven and a heart full of song. I'm washing the blues from my soul. I hit all the high spots, found they were vain. To lose that false pleasure was really to gain. Lordy, can't you see? I'm washing the blues from my soul. I lifted my hope to the highest and found a world friendly and true. Now right where you are, you can find it. You only need the right point of view. I put off the old way, took on the new. The clouds are divided, the light shining through. Lordy, can't you see? I'm washing the blues from my soul.
Sophie Tucker, recorded in London. Now, around that time, the career of a young Jewish British musician was just about beginning. His name was Sid Phillips. He was actually born Isidore Simon Sid Phillips, and Sid was just his nickname. He was born in 1907, died in 1973, and in between, he became one of the most talented musicians. He played clarinet and saxes, and particularly arranger that we had in the whole of the UK. He began his career not only recording under his own name, but writing arrangements for Bert Ambrose, the famous dance band. And indeed, he joined Ambrose's band, remaining there till 1937. He performed in the USA, on radio and live. He ran bands during World War II in the RAF and put together his own quartet in 1946. Wrote even symphonic pieces, and well, he became a pretty well-known name in British jazz circles. He did, as I say, make records under his own name. The only reason I think that he didn't become as big a name as people like Ambrose is that perhaps he was too much of a musician, by which I mean that he was more interested in the development of modern music, which then would have been jazz, than having hits per se. The record I'm going to play you now is a good example of that. This is one of his own arrangements, and it was recorded in December 1938, when this would have been a pretty progressive piece of music, and maybe not designed as a commercial hit. So, while it's most impressive musically, what's perhaps missing is what they would now call the hook line. There's no tune that you really remember, And of course, it's very much an instrumental, no vocal is involved. Nevertheless, it's fascinating to hear this. I'm friends with Sid's nephew, who's called John Altman, and who's all over Facebook, if you're a Facebook person. He owns Sid's clarinet, he plays it, and just like Sid himself, has become a first-class arranger. Incidentally, Sid wasn't an only child, he had brothers, and Wolf Phillips, his brother, became almost as well-known as his brother Sid for running bands, arranging and accompanying stars at the London Palladium, and so on. So it's a whole family full of talent. Sid's son, also called Simon Phillips, is known as a fine drummer. So it's a whole sort of dynasty of Phillips. This then is Voodoo, as performed by Sid Phillips and his recording ensemble, shall we say, in December 1938. Voodoo. Sid Phillips, who you might call the ultimate pro, at least as far as the UK is concerned, fine, fine musician. And of course, that's just one of the styles in which he played. He was very, very versatile. Well, with me, brought up on opera, Duke Ellington, and of course later, Bossa Nova, harmonic sophistication has always been at the base of the sort of music I like, and therefore I've never really been a fan of basic country blues as typified by people like Howling Wolf or Muddy Waters. There's an exception, however. I remember often on TV, because he became popular in the UK as part of the burgeoning folk world, I remember watching a blues singer on BBC called Josh White. He would sing thoughtful blues. His voice wasn't the usual type of blues voice. It was rather more sophisticated in timbre. And I remember he used to have a cigarette impaled on the end of the string coming out of the top of his guitar. And they always used to film him with that sort of pall of smoke rising heavenwards as he sang. And I used to like his singing. I liked the tone of his voice. Josh White turned out to have lived a fascinating life. His years are 1914 to 1969. He didn't live too long, sadly. He was the son of a black priest, you might say, the Reverend Dennis White, and he was born in South Carolina. When his father was thrown in jail after an incident involving a white bill collector, Josh was sent out to earn money by bottling, as we would say in England, collecting money for blind blues singers. I've read that he did this for Blind Lemon Jefferson. Blind Blake was another, certainly. Blind Joe McTaggart. They all needed a young lad to maybe help the entertainment and certainly to collect money for them. And he'd carry on like this for quite a while, naturally picking up all sorts of talents of the guitar styles of these people with whom he was working. Well, to cut a long story short, at some point he was seen by a talent scout for one of the recording companies. Being underage, they had to persuade his mother that he wouldn't be singing the blues on records, but only religious music, which is what he did at first. He finally did record the blues, and in order to disassociate his own name with it, he used a sort of nom de recording, Pinewood Tom, and he soon became pretty successful, to the extent that he even got to know and be friends with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. However, he was also involved in the odd fight or two. He felt very, very strongly about the racial discrimination that was so common back then, the Jim Crow laws, and he began to add all sorts of songs to his repertoire involving the demand for civil rights and so forth, long, long before the time when this was in vogue. Because of his what were regarded as left-wing speeches, he therefore became a victim of McCarthyism and accused of being a communist, which is probably why in later years he had to perform abroad, particularly, as I say, popular in the UK. And that's where I heard him. Well, this is one of his mid-40s recordings, and I think you can hear the sophisticated style with which he sang. And this is a normal sort of blues of the time called Backwater Blues. He recorded this in the USA in 1944. As usual with blues recordings, they haven't been looked after, and I've had a lot of trouble cleaning it up, so it's a bit mushy. Nevertheless, I think you can hear his style quite clearly on this record, and I commend him to you, Josh White.
It rained 5 days, skies turned dark as night. Well, it rained 5 days, skies turn dark as night. Trouble was taking place in that lowland at night. Well, it thundered and lightened, and that wind began to blow. Well, it thundered and lightened, wind began to blow. Thousands of people didn't have nowhere to go. Then they rowed a little boat about 5 miles across the pond. Well, they rowed a little boat about 5 miles across the pond. Packed my clothes and thought a minute, and they rowed for me alone. Then I went and stood upon a high old lonesome hill. Then I went and stood upon a high old lonesome hill. Looked down on the place, Jimmy, where I used to live. Backwater blues caused me to pack my things and go. Backwater blues made me pack my things and go. My house fell down and I can't live there no more.
Josh White, and I think, as I said before, you can hear immediately how sophisticated his style was, both vocally and indeed in his guitar styles, compared with so many other blues singers. For some, this meant that he wasn't a true blues singer. For me, that made him quite superior. Well, now, as they say, for something completely different. Some people are before their time. Josh White didn't live very long. This poor man had his life cut short in a very tragic way. His name was Harry Fragson. He was the son of continental people. His father was either French or Belgian, I'm never quite sure which. And he was brought up by his father and I think a second or first wife, but not his mother, I think, who was also from the continent. Although born in England, he lived in Paris for a while and indeed first became famous as a performer over there making records. He only really returned to England in the early years of the 20th century, say about 1905, and became very, very well known for the more sophisticated of songs which he would sing accompanying himself at the grand piano. And the sort of songs that he was singing in a way predated the sort of stuff that Flanders and Swann would be famous for half a century later. One of his big hits was called Hello, Hello, Who's Your Lady Friend? So he would have been singing the sort of songs that were just slightly naughty because of his Parisian background. Paris was regarded then as the source of all things slightly naughty. He had a fairly short recording career in England, first recording here in 1909, and his last recordings were in late December 1913. After which he must have gone back to Paris, where his father was living, and his father had gone slightly balmy. For some unknown reason, the father had believed that Fragson was going to put him into a home, and he became rather depressed and unstable about this. Fragson returned home one evening, I think it was the 30th of December in 1913, to find his father with a gun in his hand, apparently intending to commit suicide. When Fragson entered, however, his father instead pointed the gun at his son, shooting him dead. The father himself died 6 weeks later in an asylum, so a really tragic end. Harry Fragson was only 44. This song shows how innovative and modern he was because it's a comedy song which I believe he wrote himself, and the song is about a very newfangled invention at that time, the departmental store. They'd only really come into existence towards the end of the Victorian era and were still somewhat a novelty. This is a song about how even then people would try and sell you stuff that you didn't really want. They didn't cold call you on the phone to sell you insurance, but if you went to the wrong department of a big store, they would try and sell you anything, whether you were out to shop for that or not. And that's the source of the comedy in this song. I think it's wonderful, particularly for its day. It was recorded on the 12th of January, 1912, in London, and it's a great tragedy that he didn't survive longer. As I say, he was born in 1869 and was only 44 when he was shot dead by his own father. However, we do have this memory of him, Harry Fragson.
I promised the wife the other day a yard of lace I'd bring from one of these department stores we think to live to take. So if you've got an hour to spare, describe to you, I'll try a list of all the articles they wanted me to buy. I went to count the number one, the shop, and said, how do? It's been a lovely day today, what can I do for you? I said, I want a yard of lace. I'm sorry, he replied, but this department furniture, you want the other side. But all the same, while you're here, let me show chiffonier, going cheap, sacrifice, sell to you half the price. Here I've got the baby's got its face for one, but all the lovely it's out all the go. I said, whoa, 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 half a though, I want a yard of lace. He said, the lace, sir? Yes, lace. Oh, the other department, if you please, they dumped the number fares. They dumped the fares, I'm in the front of the shop, I said, how do? It's a lovely day today, what can I do for you? I said, I want a yard of lace. He answered with a leer, you're in the wrong department, sir, but still while you are here, so let me show, if I may, how new stock in today. Underwear, special lines, flannel shirts, 1 and 9, fancy vest, bowler hat, lemon fat, choice cravat, cricket bat, dear skin bat, away from cats, I said rat. I want a yard of lace. He said, lace, sir? Yes, lace. What do you think I want? A couple of white mice or a pink elephant dressed in a harem skirt? Lace, L-A-C-E. Oh, the other department in your feet, they come to dump the fair. They dump the stairs, I'm in the game, the shop, the tear down, oh. It's been the lucky day today, what can I do for you? I said, I want a yard of lace. He said, we've only got in this department grocery. But while you're on the spot, here's some jam, ham and lamb, spotted by Uncle Sam. Lovely cheese, walks in ease, warble glees in the breeze. You ladies, fresh today, gonna pump up, lift us spray. The night soap, lost all hope, I said, oh, hang your soap. I want a yard of it. Geez, hang it all, late. Haven't you got any common sense in this shop? He said, not today, sir. We expect some in tomorrow. Oh, we've a government job on. Yes, sir. Making zones of silence for the new cabinet. But for lace, sir, the other department is to be set on the down the stairs. Down the stairs? Just to the bottom floor. Oh, then down the stairs I went again. I found the face at last. The something vermin, what to you? My heart was beating fast. I said, I want the yard of lace to match it for the wife. I've never had a search like this before in all my life. Then, with a smile spread over his face, I handed to him the sample of lace. I want a yard like that, sir, I cried. But he, with clarion voice, replied, I'm sorry, sir, to put you about, but this kind of lace, sir, I've just sold out.
Harry Fragson. I wonder what he would have come up with had he survived. Tragic end. Well, we're doing a sort of tour of Europe this time somehow. We started off with a German baritone. The last artist was sort of semi-French at least. And now we're going to have a famous great Spanish bass. And his name was Jose, if I'm pronouncing it properly, Jose Mardones. And what can I say about him? I think the main thing we always say is he had an absolutely magnificent bass voice. My problem with him when singing opera is that sometimes his singing isn't of the most musical type, in the sense that his phrasing is never really satisfying the way it is with the really great singers. Nevertheless, just the quality of his voice enabled him to enjoy a really fine career. He was born at a place called Fonteca and began his musical life singing, well, soprano before his voice broke. So he began as a sort of choral singer. He then studied at the Conservatory of Madrid, but from what I understand, most of what he did was self-taught. He didn't really have the full vocal training. Maybe that's the reason that his mode of expression isn't satisfying. Maybe he needed more of that. I don't know. He appeared for the first time in Buenos Aires, so he started his career abroad in South America, as so many singers did, and he sang in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. But mostly he sang in Spanish opera houses, and not only opera, but zarzuela, the sort of, what should we say, the light opera of its type in Spain. This is all from about 1909 to 1914 or so. In 1916, during the war, he was actually engaged in Boston in America and made a lot of recordings there. He'd been invited already by Toscanini to sing the bass solo in Verdi's Requiem. In 1917, he then changed from Boston to the Metropolitan, which was really the supreme house in America for quite a long time. And he carried on appearing there till 1926. He was even first choice over such fine singers as Adamo Didur, Andrés de Segurola, another Spanish bass, and Léon Rottier, simply because of the quality of his voice. Well, I'm going to give you not a piece of opera where I never find him quite right, but where he does sound great is singing Spanish songs, because he was Spanish, he knew how to sing them, it was sort of in his blood, as it were. This is the very, very famous Ay, Ay, Ay. Everybody knows that song, I think, if you know songs of that nature at all. Very famous song, everybody sang it. This was recorded at the height of his fame, you might say, on the 2nd of March 1920 in the USA. And the voice is fantastic, and for once, the sort of stuff he's singing, he fully understands, and it works really well. José Mardones. José Mardones, I think it is best there, in 1920, singing Ay Ay Ay. His years, by the way, were 1869, he was born, and he died in 1932 in Spain. Well, believe it or not, I'm a bass myself, although I have none of that richness, or maybe I would have been an opera singer myself. Instead, I sing jazz, write songs, sing pop songs, sing bossa nova, and it's now the time to play one of my tracks. Before I do so, as always, whether you have email, whether you are on Facebook, whether you are on Twitter or any other form of social communication, please tell your friends about this podcast so that more people can share the music which is hidden in these now half-forgotten 78s of all those years ago, because I think the music's magnificent. What I'm going to give you this time is a live performance I did at a charity concert I do every year, which is in aid of research into breast cancer. It sounds a bit grim, but in fact the concert's great fun. We have all sorts of jazz singers, all sorts of cabaret artists, the odd comedian, all sorts of things. It's wonderful. And I seem to be, I think, on form when I did this. This is one of the classic bossa novas by Antonio Carlos Jobim. It's called Corcovado, and this was recorded live in Norwich, September, a few years ago, and I hope you'll enjoy it. The sound quality isn't of the best, but I think perfectly listenable too, and one of my better performances, I like to flatter myself. So until next time, I say au revoir, and hoping that by then you'll have told all your friends and will have thousands of people listening to these wonderful records. Let's go viral, everybody. Ciao for now.
Cantinho, violão, este amor, uma canção. pra fazer feliz a quem se ama. Muita calma pra pensar é ter tempo pra sonhar. Da janela vê se o Corcovado Redentor. Que lindo. Quero a vida sempre assim, com você perto de mim, até eu apagar a velha chama. Eu que era triste, descrente deste mundo, ao encontrar você eu conheci. Oh, que felicidade, meu amor. Quiet nights of quiet stars, quiet chords on my guitar, floating down the silence that surrounds us. Quiet thoughts and quiet dreams, quiet walks by quiet streams, climbing hills where lovers go to watch the world below. Together we will live eternally in this world of reverie, so far from all the earthly cares around us. My world was dull each minute until I found you in it. Then all at once the happiness I knew became these quiet nights of loving you, of loving you.